Great. Thank you. And with the messages of the heart, I think we can also feel a heart connection with each other right now. Just a sense that we are linked in an invisible net, if you like. Awareness is holding us all together right now. And let's just feel that, let it touch our heart that we're a sangha and we're together. Never mind where you are physically. And you're not seeing each other on the screen, but in the consciousness, we are there. So, this evening, I want to explore a little bit the issues of beyond boundaries. And it's been an important issue for me personally. And in the teaching, mindfulness, in its kind of the way it arrived in the Western culture, based on Satipatthana Sutta, it's favored going inside. In other words, meditation we can define, usually is defined as kind of dropping in, and we shut our eyes and we go back inside and we meet our inner life. And this is really, really important because most of our life we are just so busy struggling, coping, fixing, doing, managing, and needing to control things in a way to survive. And it's all out, out, out. So when we come back to react, in a sense, to see things as they are, I think it's absolutely wise to make a balance to go back in. That means to connect with our body and our bodily life. And indeed, in the Satipatthana Sutta, the first place is Kaya, the body and the breath. However, in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha said, inside and outside. Put your attention in and out. And so this opens a whole kind of field of exploration, and it goes to places where we can feel that our awareness is going out. Is taking us into the world is not just in and is together in and out. You might have practiced big mind meditations before, you might have touched Tibetan practices of sky gazing or sky-like mind. But very simply, you might all love open spaces. You might all like to lie down and watch the night sky. You might be sitting in front of the sea if you're lucky enough to and really be inspired by the infinity, by the sense of openness, by the endlessness of nature and of something unlimited that reminds us of what's unlimited in our consciousness, not just in, but in relationship to everything else as well. So, there are issues around that, of course. The minute we talk about boundary, there are voices saying, well, I need my boundaries. And there are voices that say, it's a bit scary to feel that I'm not sure where my boundaries are or to go out of my safe zone. And all of that is certainly part of the picture. We can't just kind of be in an idealistic. But we should also consider why there is so much Dharma guidance in the suttas and in the texts on space and spaciousness. And how is it that the language of dukkha, of suffering, of difficulty, is all about contraction? It's all about how we feel contracted or how we feel separate or how we feel shut down or how we feel withdrawn. And there is the kind of place of dukkha, of pain, of suffering. and so we do need to kind of explore this. And this is really what I'll try and do this evening. And to mention some of the formless states, arupa, meaning what are the states that the Buddha talked about and that we can possibly practice, which are spaciousness, which are endlessness, which are limitlessness, And I'll give a talk on that after the meditation. The meditation itself will be, we've got maybe a little bit less than half an hour now, but I will be addressing some of these things in the meditation, in the guided meditation, and a little bit exploring the way the consciousness can be kind of flexible and free, and exploring beyond, this is the word I use, basically it comes from the Heart Sutta, beyond Gata Gata. How we do that, how we can kind of feel awareness is able to be freer and more flexible. So we'll do that in the meditation, and then we'll talk about it. And then, of course, questions, delighted. So, wherever you are at this moment, quite important to really relax and feel this meditation starts off with no pressure and no sense that there's something to be done or to be obtained. So we can just gently close our eyes. Relax the body. Relax the mind. A sense of settling into the one seat that we are inhabiting right now. And I suggest that we just get a sense of being alive and present and existing in a very general, open way. I know I am here. Nothing special to focus on right now. And as we do this, the senses are going to be connecting us to the world around. The sounds outside, whatever they are, even my voice, but maybe there is traffic, maybe there is nature, maybe there's other people, doesn't matter what the sounds are, but get a sense that sound connects us to the world around us. Sight connects us maybe to colors in front of the eyes, even the eyes are closed. Touch connects us to the seat, to the cushion, to the floor. There may be smells and tastes. And there may be voices in the mind, the sense of memory or thought or picture. Just get a sense that all of these senses are there and they're not in any special place. They are connecting us. The sound isn't just in our minds or in our ears. And begin to feel an openness through the senses, we are connected. we are joined. Our inner and outer worlds are joined. The senses are gateways or doorways. So let's try and explore one or two experiences of boundary and see what these boundaries are really made of. Let's take the hands, sense of touch. What are our hands touching now? Maybe each other, or our body, or legs, or an object. And the first impression is clearly boundary. Sense of touch of each finger is touching something else that's not it. Something other than. But let's begin to zoom in on the experience of touch. What is really the experience of each finger? Pressure, energy, movement, tiny movements, change. Electricity, energy. Zoom in. Zoom into one finger. What's the experience of touch and pressure? It's like a load of pixels. Changing. And as we see that, and as we sense it, the sense of boundary is no longer relevant. There is the bubbling life of one finger. It's not even one finger, it's just bubbling life. Let's do this with our whole sitting posture. Gravity is pulling us down. We feel ourselves pulled down to the chair. The weight of the body. Can we just let go and feel the weight of the body, feel gravity? And the earth and the ground is pulling us. Let gravity work through us. Let the earth welcome us. Let the earth invite us, hold us, take us. Let the pull of gravity be an experience that shows that we and the earth are intimately connected and in connection with us. The earth is inviting us and we let go into it. Can we do that now with the space around us? Just like with the earth, get a sense of where we're located, our skin, our body. Where is our body and where is non-body outside the body? We're starting with awareness of boundary, of limit, or of location. Atta, self. Now begin to reach out. What is the experience behind, above? Below is the earth, above is the sky, in front, behind. Begin to get a sense that we are sitting in space. Our experience doesn't end with those boundaries that we just noticed and paid attention to. Any way that we can sense our body in space, up and down to the sides and front and back, out and out and out. Relax and open ourselves to the space around. You can call it big mind, because it's a sense of knowing, a sense of awareness of knowing. It can be an image, it doesn't matter. It can be something tangible. It can be a sense of just interest and faith that we are in big space, like inside the balloon of space. And there is knowing, we know it. It's surrender, let go, relax, and open out. There may be thoughts and mental pictures, and let them be. They don't need to interfere. They can be part of the big picture, as if they're clouds that are drifting across the sky. And the sky-like awareness is open, endless, reaching out. And there are things happening. A thought, a sound, but can we see how they are just taking their place inside the big picture, as if they're clouds passing across the sky, or a wave crossing the ocean? And as we stay with that openness, maybe we can get a feeling that it's actually quite natural. It's natural to be open and connected to the world. It's natural to feel that our awareness reaches out. Our awareness that knows trees and leaves and stars and the earth. And just for a moment, we can understand, even reflect that what we know, the space that we know around us, is a space of knowing. It's awareness that stretches out, that reaches out. And let's bring it back now to our boundaries. Let's reconnect with our boundary. Where does our body end? And know the difference. Spaciousness, boundarylessness, and boundary. Feel the flexibility that we have in the consciousness to be able to open like that and then to come back into boundary. And what's that like, that journey between openness and beyond and being located? The self defines itself by location, is one of the ways that the self knows itself. Where is my boundary? Where am I in space? We can do one more exercise to explore that. Very gently, very slowly, we can move one hand just side to side or up and down, very slowly. With awareness and interest, knowing the hand moving, feeling that it's a bit like air. The hand itself is like air. Again, opening the sankhara, the fixed assumption of where I am located, of where is my hand, of where is the limits, of who is doing this, of who is in charge of the hand. The hand is just moving. Slowly, slowly moving itself. Backwards and forwards, very slowly. Maybe we can get a sense that no one really is doing this. and there's no special place that the hand needs to be, and that we don't even know what is the hand. Okay, and then just stop the movement, resting the hand, resting the body. Relaxing into presence without any agenda, without any purpose, without any need for anything to happen. Thank you, everybody, for the journey. And I'm be happy to share with you some reflections on issues of beyond boundary and beyond boundary. The first thing is, as you all know, and experience the sense of an enduring self, the me and the mine in here, is so powerful and so pervasive. And the sense of me being in here, looking at the world out there, is so deep and built into the system. And indeed, one of the classic ways which we practice this is to work with the contractions as they come up, with the dukkha of constructions around me, my issues, my struggles, the friction that I experience, my story. And we undo that in this classical mindful awareness, vipassana, practice with the content. And we do this and soften the content. It becomes less solid. And as we do that, the self, little by little, lets go of its story, which keeps it so strong. The me, which is right in the center. And slowly, slowly, through this practice that maybe we all know, we can a little bit touch places of emptiness, that what arises is not solid, but passing through the system, dynamic, free, and we find ourselves a little lighter and less contracted and less suffering through, I would say, classic practice of working with content. But it's also possible to explore directly the spaciousness and begin to really explore that sense that we can, in a way, I would say fake it in order to make it in a certain way, but we can experience spaciousness directly. And that changes the way that we look at content that arises, a story, a narrative, a struggle, an issue, a question, etc. And if we keep practicing spaciousness itself, gradually we find ourselves in a bigger home. That we are living in space. We are living in a bigger place. We are living in interbeing. We are living in the world. In the classic Theravada framework for this, you can describe them as the Arupa Jhanas. And the Arupa Jhanas are, in a formal sense, Jhana 5, 6, 7, 8. But I don't think we really need to define them as only if we've gone through Jhana 1, 2, 3, 4, which are states of quite sublime and subtle and deep concentration, samadhi. They're described as realms, kingdoms, places. In the tradition, they are realms, meaning kingdoms, meaning fields. And they're standing alone. So, indeed, we did experience it just now. We can experience the realms of arupa. Rupa means form or construction or elements or materials. Arupa means non-material. So it can be non-material realms or fields of the invisible or the non-material. The fifth arupa jhana, the fifth jhana or the first arupa jhana is space, spaciousness. The next one is the understanding that space is not something, but is a kind of knowing, a space of awareness, which actually we could feel right now. It's not so exotic. Right now, we can feel a space of awareness around us, through us, in our body, out of our body. We're listening to my voice. There is awareness between my voice or my picture and yourselves. It's between, it's there, it's in the world. So that would be the second arupa jhana. The third would be emptiness, nothingness, because actually, and this gets exotic a bit, but pure awareness, what is it? We can also understand it as empty, because it has no content, it has no qualities, it has no end, it has no beginning or end. The forms that it knows have beginnings and ends, but awareness is just like the womb, space of knowing. It's empty. And the fourth of the arupa jhanas is really defined in a kind of quite a strange way in the text as being no perception and no non-perception. But I just like to call it mystery, because at that place, we don't know anymore what a thing really is. Call it mystery. So, ways to touch these places. Firstly, we surrender into them. It's not about trying to grasp them or have them or pressure to get them in some way. It's much more like the Buddha said, let your meditation be like the earth, which is vast and undisturbable. Let your meditation be like the air or like the ocean, which can absorb everything. for that, we need to kind of surrender. It has much more sense of letting go into a bigger space. And at the same time, then, we notice boundary, as we did in the meditation. We notice there is a sense of spaciousness, but we notice that our body is touching itself or things or objects. And the sense is, no, okay, there's a limit. There is a hand and there's non-hand. So we know that boundary very, very well. It's built into us from the age of zero, more or less. However, when we practice meditation that has more spaciousness, we notice that we're going in and out to that place. And gradually there is more flexibility around boundary. The image, if any of you have experienced Dzogchen or Mahamudra, the Mahayana practice of boundarylessness, the image of the sky-like mind is really crucial in Dzogchen. And it's the sense of not being disturbable, meaning a thought cannot disturb the sky-like nature of awareness. Awareness is like the sky, and a thought like a cloud cannot disturb the sky. And we begin to look differently at our thoughts that way. Yes, they're there. They can feel very specific. They can feel very strong. They can feel full of story. They can feel a bit heavy. Sometimes take us over, or maybe many times. Well, that's okay. That's what happened. But if we understand thoughts differently, that they are like clouds in the sky, that they are known by the awareness, by the witnessing. They're pictures that appear and disappear. They have a very short shelf life. We can look at them differently, not as a problem, but as something that's naturally appearing from the space, like a cloud in the sky, as I say, or like a wave on the ocean. The ocean expresses itself through waves. It's all right. The wave doesn't disturb the ocean. So it does change the attitude, and many of us, in a way, can benefit from this and struggle less with content in the mind. I guess the Mahayana world has, Tibetan practice is strongly influenced by this kind of spacious practice, because Tibet's mountains. But it's something that we can really benefit from, because it's practiced so deeply there in that tradition. But all traditions have it. It's also in the Theravada tradition. For example, in the Sutta Nipata, there is a quote that says, use these two things to help you cross the ocean. The perception of nothingness and the awareness that there is nothing. Give up sense pleasures and be free from doubts, so you will begin to see and to long for an end to craving. And in the Sutta Nipata, the edition I have, which is quite a traditional old edition, it says, this refers to the third of the Arupa Jhanas. The emptiness, the nothingness, the spacious nothingness, if you like. The Heart Sutta, which has become a universal, not just a Mahayana sutta, but really a universal sutta, and quite rightly. The mantra at the end, which is in a way influenced the title of my talk. Gata, gata, para, gata, parasamgata, bodhi, swaha. Beyond, beyond the beyond, way beyond the beyond. Awareness, or pure awareness. Wow. Swaha. or Amen. But I've recently read some discussion that in the Heart Sutta, as you may know, it discusses form and emptiness, and form as nothing other than emptiness, and emptiness as nothing other than form, meaning dialogue between form and emptiness. And I've been reading discussions that this is also seen as kind of practice of the Arupa Jhanas, of their endless or spacious awareness, in which form and emptiness are in dialogue, practicing beyond boundary, formless, to have another view of form, and form to have another view of formless. So form and formless seen differently, as we did with the sky and the clouds. And then it makes a lot more sense. Form is nothing other than emptiness. Emptiness, nothing other than form. They are together. The wave and the ocean are together. So one of the places that we can practice this, and also giving us a sense of how to work with atta anatta, with self and non-self, which is so crucial and so central in the whole of the Dharma, is a little bit using the sense of spaciousness, boundaries and no boundaries, and being a bit more playful around that. And it goes into all kinds of directions, being a bit more playful, flexible around control. Am I moving my hand? Do I own my hand? Do I own my body? Do I own my digestive system? Can I control it? Can I control the blood? Can I control the cells? Can I control the breath? What do I own? What is mine? What is not mine? Where do I end and where the world begins? Location. Limit. And the way we practice this is just simply to practice again and again the sense of flexibility, the world and me together. In this way, in another way, now we feel more boundary. When someone, as you know, when someone shouts at us, we immediately get contracted around the self, strong self. When we're deeply relaxed and open, maybe sitting in front of the sea or walking through a forest, we feel much, much less selfing. Pay attention to that, the sense of flexibility, the sense of fluidity. It's not solid, this sense of me and the boundary. It's much less solid than we think. And we don't need to kind of idealize emptiness, but we can sense the flexibility and playfulness of being with self and world, and boundary is one good way to do this, maybe the easiest way to do this. We do need a little bit of help, of course. Our basic practice, all practice helps us here. We need to feel okay with this practice, and then we can allow ourselves to trust and to be, in a way, happy and at ease, and then it's easier to go out, because boundaries are about fear or insecurity, and we can a sense of the practice giving us a sense of ease or joy is really important. I remember a personal story that I want to share with you. many years ago in India, I went on a personal retreat for 6 weeks in a little tiny room in an ashram, just on my own, for my own practice. And after a while, I began to feel that right next to me, there was kind of an abyss of emptiness, or like a place of non-self that was at the same time really attractive and really scary. And I sort of wanted to jump in, but I couldn't. And every time I went to that place, I kind of jumped back. Some primal fear took me back. And it's like all the time next to me, this abyss. And I spoke to a teacher there that I met, and he said, don't forget, your happiness will help you reduce the fear. And if there's basic happiness and okayness, you'll find that you can go to places you don't know, or you're afraid of. So I thanked him and explored that a bit. But actually what happened, as you might have guessed, is that I realized that the whole thing was a big construction and didn't exist. The abyss wasn't really there. And so I kind of spent the rest of the retreat just really hanging out and enjoying being and a certain lightness. But there wasn't a sort of sense of this duality. I am here and I want to jump into the beyond. It wasn't quite like that. So I know that, of course, we need boundaries at times, and maybe this is one of the questions that might come up, and naturally just come up. We do need boundaries. We need to know where I end and the world begins in a functional sense so that we can cross the road safely. Of course, we need to know. That's why we have a self, and that's why we have boundaries, so that we can survive. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that it has to totally control our consciousness, that we have to put ourselves in the box absolutely all the time and close ourselves in that. And so we can play with going beyond boundaries, going beyond. We can explore it. And we'll find our consciousness, our awareness gets freer, more open, and more limitless. And when we need a boundary, of course it'll be there, because it's structured into the brain cells. Of course we'll drive a car. So I would like to quote, I've written a new book, which is a novel, actually, a Dharma novel. And I just want to quote a small piece at the end of the book, with personal reflection. This morning, I found myself jogging along the dirt roads that turned to asphalt and back to dirt roads, which were paved stories of compromise. Running to nowhere, coming from nowhere. There is a body. Its legs are moving rhythmically. Its arms are swinging. It is running steadily. There are soothing, whooshing sounds of the air going in and out of the lungs. Tender thuds of the heartbeat in working mode, but without urgency. The world around, of wild aniseed, clover, nettles, grasses, and stone terraces, constantly appearing and disappearing. Both body and world are in motion as one. All is in movement. And if so, where can it all go? Nothing is going to or from anywhere. Everything is still and everything is moving. There is an endless knowing. It feels like an ocean on which a few light thoughts, such as these words, are little laughing ripples lapping each other and vanishing back into the knowing that gave them birth. So finally, I want to say that out in Israel where I live, I was approached by some scientists who were interested in brain studies, and they asked me, and they were also practitioners, they asked me, tell us what would be really, really interesting to research in the lab. And I said, sense of self and beyond, because it's not really been an object of research that much, and it's so crucial in the Dharma. So we did some studies first on myself as a subject, and then I trained 50 people in a three-week course on working with boundaries and beyond boundaries, and then the next series of studies was on them. And it was a psychoneurophenomenology, meaning deep, deep, detailed questioning of first-person experience in a very disciplined way, and at the same time looking at the brain in a MEG machine, which is non-invasive. It's not like an MRI. It's not so noisy. And really, it was. We published several papers on this, which have been around. And it's been really, really interesting for all of us taking part, exploring boundary. That means really giving it interest. Where do I end? And then exploring beyond boundary, spacing out exactly, or spacing, being in space beyond the boundary. And then in a way being limitless or dissolving all sense of limit. And in those three categories, we were tested in the laboratory and also by questioning psychoneurophenomenology. So it's really interesting for me to go through that, by the way. As a scientist, then I became the guinea pig because I trained as a scientist originally. And to be in the machine, MEG. And just be there and be out and in. I found it fascinating. A couple of final points, implications. It's not just kind of acrobatics we're doing. It has implications because it makes us less dualistic of us here against the world. It's us and the world. It's us as part of the world. It's the world looking out of our eyes. It's fundamental in a certain way to liberation. I would say small doses of liberation. And at the same time, it's a connection with the world that we really need when we get up in the morning to look out and to feel connected with the people in the street, with the sky above, with the ants crossing the path. We will feel this anywhere. When we go on retreat, we will feel connected, but we can practice and explore it directly. The sense of being with, being in a bigger space, being connected. And of course, it brings compassion. Because if we're connected not just with consciousness. Our consciousness is our heart. Our heart is our consciousness. The two are together. So that's all I want to say for the moment. Let's just take two breaths and have a moment of contemplation. So before the questions, I do want to echo what George has mentioned about dana, and just basically say that dana is such a classical way of expressing connection, our interbeing with the world. How are we with the world? Giving and receiving is the way we are in the world. So that's why it's the first of the paramis. The way we are in the world, when we're not less locked in the cell of what I need and what I cannot and what I can, or it's just an expression of our interbeing, interconnection, and we express it through primal giving and receiving. And we can just take part of that as we feel is right and appropriate in any way. So I'm happy to have questions. I see there's five questions. Arupa Jhanas, I did mention in my talk, Arupa means formless. Arupa is the word for form or things or elements, earth, air, fire, water, world, materials. So Arupa means non-material, invisible, not material. And jhana, as I said in my talk, is the states of concentration and often deep concentration. But the arupa jhanas I've used them in a slightly different way, not as states of deep concentration that you have to go through in order to reach places of, if you like, a samadhi, but awareness or directing our awareness to spacious places. And the tradition, I think, you can interpret the tradition as agreeing with that, because they're talked about as realms or kingdoms. And I have another question, thank you. Can you please let us know where we could find the published studies that you mentioned? If you could share the name of the researchers or journal, would be great, thank you. Well, they're great long names, Journal of Consciousness. Is there a way that I can send the papers, but I don't know quite where to send them. If I send them to George, maybe George, you could send them on. But I can't at this minute write them in the chat because I don't remember the details and the titles of them. So I don't quite know how to do that. I don't have them in front of me. I can't write them in the chat. But I could send them later. Or what I can do is if you open my website, I'll make sure that they're going to be there. I'll put them in the blog in my website. Actually, maybe they're already there. I don't know. I don't remember. But open my website and I'll put them in the next 2 or 3 days. I'll put them on Wednesday, actually. I'll put them in the blog and they'll be all there, 3 or 4 full papers, international, very detailed. Yeah, so interesting question here. How can a person confirm that they have had a jhanic experience? Jhana also reminds me of non-dual experiences facilitated by the use of plant medicines and psychedelics. Is there any connection between the two? This is an interesting question. Let's put it this way. If we're talking about jhana, then jhanic states, we really mean the first four, which are much more defined and are really, I would say, sort of deeply central to the development of samadhi from the time of the Buddha onwards. The Buddha kept talking about jhana and jhanic states. They're basically states of the first four are basically states of deep concentration where you dive in to the object of concentration, and the rest of the world begins to get less and less and less relevant, and states of energy emerge. So one of the places that you can notice, you can confirm jhanic experiences of the first four would be states of ecstasy, states of energy, states of elation, states of enthusiasm. The heart is touched as well. So you're diving into a place and you can kind of feel, if you go deep, there is a vibration there that fills the being. And then as you go through the different jhanic states, these energetic experiences get more and more subtle. And the ecstasy becomes more like more gentle, more equanimous, more soft, more like just well-being, and not so ecstatic. And that's one of the ways you recognize or confirm a jhanic experience. But the way that I'm using the language, it's a bit of a problem always to use language, but the four states I've talked about are not classical jhanas in that sense that they are not going to necessarily create experiences of ecstasy or energy or electricity, or not necessarily wild at all. So there tends to be much more, just as you say in your question, non-dual experiences. But non-dual experiences don't need to be facilitated by the use of plant medicines and psychedelics. There is a connection. There is certainly a connection between the kind of experiences that are possible in plant medicine and psychedelics, but they are temporary experiences that are passing. They can open a door, but they're not necessarily going to stay with us as a state that help us live in the world in a totally different way. They can open a door, but we need some deep practice to make sure that the door keeps open. If you like, there's another way you can look at it in a more neurological sense. Most of the brain is busy with inhibition. That means when I look at a tree, the networks in the brain tell me, okay, here's a tree. We remember this is the shape. This is what it is. We've seen it a million times. And it restricts the experience in that way. And what restricts the experience is the inhibition of millions of other possible impressions that are not relevant in this moment when we look at tree. So most of the experience of the brain and most of the energy of the brain is going into inhibition, shutting down everything except the one thing that's interesting to me, tree, and defining it. And asking if it's good for me, and asking how I like it. And we're into sankharas. Sankharas are structures of experience, which are attached, which are stuck. Plant medicines can, in a way, reduce the inhibition. And so we begin to sense a much bigger space. Though a tree becomes maybe a dynamic, colorful, moving, magical experience because it's less shut down, it's less controlled, it's less tight, it's less locked into a specific network. So I've got a talk again on psychedelics and Dharma in my my website. And basically I say that you need to be careful. about the whole thing. It isn't. You, there's no, in the end, real shortcuts to kind of instant awakening here. But there are certainly experiences that can facilitate and help this process. And for some people, in some way, a psychedelic experience, which is right for the person, which is done in the right way, with the right setting, in the right way, and fitting, and respectful, and ethical, can certainly open doors, just as a teacher or an experience which is amazing in another way, which in a thousand different ways, experiences can open doors. So it's not that we have to have a psychedelic experience for this, but it can be one of the places that can open a door, but it can't keep the door open. We have to go through that door and live differently. So there are similarities, but we have to be careful and know what we're doing here. And non-dual experiences, actually, in a way, there isn't such a thing as a non-dual experience. Experience is duality, is dual already. And experience is me and the world. So non-duality is a kind of sense of just everything I've been talking about, being the world, being dissolved in the world and myself being one. And in a way, it's natural. We were born like that. Then we developed duality called me here and the world out there. So thank you, Charles. Another question. Mindfulness meditation, as it is now taught, is so focused on the present moment and its content of thought and body sensations. It seems very limiting in the terms of practice you have described today. This makes me sad. Well, your title, Mudita Karuna, will show you that mindfulness meditation, as you described it and as it is now taught in the limited way, is certainly limited. And mudita and karuna are examples of what is not limited in your own name. So I think we have to have a bigger view of mindfulness meditation. I actually think mindfulness meditation is it's beautiful in the way that it has swept through the Western world and is offering so much, but it is also a doorway and it's also a beginning. And for example, in my book, The Five Powers, I talk about four other powers along with mindfulness that are needed to complement mindfulness, which are trust, virya, energy, vitality, determination. Samadhi was what we're talking about, concentration, steadiness, focus, wisdom, and so on. So the mindfulness is great because it's here in the Western world for the last 50, 60 years. But we do have to look at it more carefully. The last words of the Buddha were practice apamada with determination, persistently. And apamada is mindfulness or awareness with care, with a heart. Be full of care. It's a bigger knowing than just being mindful. And yes, present moment is a bit of a slogan. Of course, we need to be in the present and be aware of our thought and body sensations. But that's the beginning. It opens out from there. Because when we look at thought, we will also look at the seer of the thought. When we look at body sensations, we also begin to see the way all the sensations are flowing And we'll see vitality, and we'll see, listen to the cells, and we listen to the breath, and we begin to see that the breath comes from the trees and goes back to the trees. So mindfulness meditation, not a problem. It's a beautiful thing, but we need to take it further. Millions of people will not do that. That's the name of the game. I'm not sure that we can do much about that, but it's an opportunity for people to go into something which is so needed in our world, which is connection, reconnection with ourself, with the world, and take care and take responsibility. So I'm very happy with the way mindfulness meditation has arrived, but we should be very clear that the way it's taught in the mass culture of mindfulness is just the beginning. That's where we start. Charles, yeah. Is there a neuroanatomical correlate for the sense of self? Does this sense of self have a seat in the brain, like balance in the cerebellum or vision in the occipital lobe? A little bit. It's beyond me. Here, I must say my scientific work as a scientist was in a totally different field, which is herbal medicine and so on. I have never studied neuroanatomy. I've been the subject. They've looked at my brain, but I don't know what's going on in my brain. I can't see my brain. What I think, if you could look at the articles that we've published, I haven't written them, of course. There is a discussion there about this, where is the self? And there is a place in the, which is a sort of a, some kind of a seat of the self, which is perhaps dominant in the sense of self. But very much I understand from scientists that the sense of self is everywhere, that like every thought has in it a little voice saying mine. And every type of thought, so if you have a look at a tree, you have a sense of the tree and me. It's not that you become the tree. So that the sense of self is sort of distributed everywhere. So I don't think it's very strictly a particular region, but there is a region, I believe, which is a bit more a seat of the self than the others, but it tends to be everywhere. Again, as I say, I'll make sure that these papers are up in the blog, on my website, and it will happen on Wednesday, as I say, because that's the day someone comes to give me a hand. So thank you. So we have one last question from Michelle. It's a lovely question, Michelle. Thank you. Are stillness and spaciousness part and parcel of each other? It's a beautiful question. Let's look at it the other way. Friction is noise, where two things kind of bump into each other, where two things are against each other. Most of the noise in our life, most of the agitation in our life is built around us as an entity, as a self, struggling, doing, needing to control, needing to get things a certain way, needing to avoid damage, harm, or hurt, or other people's conflict, views, reactions, reactivity, defensiveness, all of that creates a lot of, if you like, noise. And defensiveness, for example, a lot of noise. So it's spaciousness does help stillness, because we in a way dissolve or soften the duality of me struggling in the world and against the world and having to control. So spaciousness would tend to create stillness, less waves, more of an ocean, more of a oceanic feeling. I'll give you an example, which is maybe quite potent in a way. If you can look in the eyes of another person and you sense there the spaciousness of the other person, you sense that the other person is an ocean. You sense that you yourself are an ocean, that your inner world is huge and vast, and another person's inner world is huge and vast. And from this place, things are much less likely to be in the conflict, the noise of conflict and smallness and struggle one against another. So as much as we can, spaciousness, I would say, is to some extent a practice, if you like. It's partly that we practice spaciousness in order to reconnect ourselves with the world and the sense of belonging. And it's that sense of belonging and the bigness of things that makes us feel still, like a still, deep pool. So thank you, Michelle, for that question. So, I think there's no new questions, and we've come to the time, I guess. George, is there something you want to add at this point, or shall I just say goodbye to everybody?
Nothing I need to add, Stephen, just to thank you for this session. And it's was a wonderful, wonderful, deep reflection. And it seems there are no more questions. We're just going to sit with all this. And again, thank you for your willingness and your presence. And thank you, everybody. And yeah, that's it. Just let's all go in peace.
Wonderful. Blessings to everybody. Absolutely. Bye.